on the secular history timeline on page 4 of part 1. You'll find down there it says 1896 and 1897. In 1896, the Jewish state was proposed by Theodor Herzl in a pamphlet, Der Judenstaat. The idea of setting up a separate state of Israel was born in an idea in 1896. And then in 1897, the first Zionist International Congress was held at Basel, Switzerland in 1897. Thus the embryo of a state of Israel and things that would happen in Jerusalem had already come to pass. Furthermore, there were developments in the papacy and in the kingdom of Italy. Soon after 1844, there was the promulgation of the dogma of the Immaculate Conception in 1854. And this laid the groundwork for a false concept of the Incarnation. The dogma of the Immaculate Conception. Then in 1869 was the first Vatican Council. 1869 and 1870, or 71. The first Vatican Council. And it's very interesting, there was a Vatican Council that came there and preceded the messages that we stand upon the borders of the eternal world. And there's a second Vatican Council of recent years. And this first Vatican Council, the thing that was actually adopted was the infallibility of the Pope when he spoke ex cathedra from the chair. That was the dogma that was promulgated in Vatican I, the infallibility of the Pope. But there were political developments in Italy at the same time. The Kingdom of Italy annexed the Papal States in 1870. However, in 1871, the Parliament of Italy passed what was called a law of guarantee, a generous allotment to the papacy, to the Vatican, in order to bring about closer ties between the government and the Vatican. It allowed for papal ownership of the Vatican and the Lateran palaces and diplomatic immunity for foreign representatives attached to the papal court. In other words, the Italian Parliament made provision for the beginning of the healing of the deadly wound, but the Pope would not accept it and declared himself to be a prisoner of the Vatican. That's how close that came at that particular time of fulfilling prophecy. The whole thing subsided. Now we must turn our attention to the development of these movements in history and the trends in the church. And if you'll notice the timeline on page 2 of your part 2, you'll find that we began our SDA church history line at 1920. As very little of significance happened between 1903 and 1920. However, during that period, which we are not covering, Ellen G. White died in 1915. And in her death, the church had to adjust itself to no longer having an authoritative voice to which to turn for counsel. And in 1919, there was also a Bible conference that we just learned about in recent years that reassessed the role and the writings of Ellen G. White. Now, the first focus of our attention will be on the years of 1926 to 1931. In fact, we're going to have three focuses this afternoon. And you can see there on page 2 of your timeline of Seventh-day Adventist church history, the first focus will be on the 26-31, the second focus will involve 1950-56, and then the third focus from 1967 to our own hour. Now in this first focus, as noted on page 3 of your study guide, there are three things that we're going to note. In 1926, there was a General Conference Executive Committee action that we need to note. In 1931, there was a new statement of belief placed in the yearbook. And in 1929, on the secular line, was the healing of the deadly wound. Interestingly, I'm quoting this from the book So Much in Common. This was put in this book to show the ecumenical attitude of the Seventh-day Adventist Church in relationship to all the other churches. And so let us notice carefully what they enacted in 1926. In the desire to avoid occasion for misunderstanding or friction in the matter of relationship to the work of other societies, the following statement of principles is set forth as a guidance to our workers in mission fields and in their contact with other religious organizations. 1. We recognize every agency that lifts up Christ before men as a part of a divine plan for the evangelization of the world. Now, in the rest of the statement, some of which is here and some of which is not, the motivation for this statement is worthy of consideration. In other words, it was not the idea of our men as they went into the mission field and set up mission stations, but because they might be able to offer a better salary to a native worker, that native worker would cease to be Presbyterian or a Methodist and become an Adventist. Or that if somebody had been kicked out because of moral conduct in the other missions, that he could come in and get into the Adventist mission very readily. They were trying to keep this kind of thing from developing. But behind it is a concept. Did God give a unique message and a picture of the true Christ to the Adventist Church? Is the fact that Christ is our great high priest ministering in the most holy place of the heavenly sanctuary something that can be placed on a level of the other concepts of Christ of other missions? Now, what about the year 1931? Affirm in his Movement of Destiny on page 409 says this: the year 1931 stands out as a really momentous, yet little heralded transition point essential to the destined final advance. Prune says 1931, Movement of Destiny, page 409, says that that year stands out as a really momentous, yet little heralded transition point in the history of the church. He also brings out on his pages 409 and 415 of the book Movement of Destiny the background for the new statement of belief that was placed in the yearbook in 1931. Now, while Fulham in his explanation emphasizes the change in the doctrine of God and the doctrine of Christ, there were serious omissions. And so if you'll notice here on page 4, the 1914 yearbook said, in point 13, that as the man of sin, the papacy, has sought to change times and laws, the law of God, Daniel 7:25, and has misled almost all Christendom in regard to the fourth commandment, we find the prophecy of reform in this respect to be wrought among believers just before the coming of Christ. This statement was changed in the 1931 statement of belief to read, for God in the time of the judgment in accordance with his uniform dealings with the human family in warning them of coming events, vitally affecting their destiny, Amos 3, 6 and 7, sends forth a proclamation of the approach of the second advent of Christ, that this work is symbolized by the three angels of Revelation 14, and that their threefold message brings to view a work of reform to prepare a people to meet him at his coming. They omitted any mention of the papacy as a man of sin. Furthermore, the entire paragraph in the 1914 yearbook that talked about the significance of prophecy for God's people in the final hour of human history, that was omitted. So not only the changes, but the omissions are just as vital to consider. Now, in 1929, just prior to the issuing of this 1931 statement, the healing of the deadly wound took place. And notice what the San Francisco Chronicle of February 12, 1929, on page 1, as a sub-headline, had to say, Mussolini and Gasparri sign historic Roman pact, Vatican again at peace with Italy after a long quarrel, and over the picture of Cardinal Gasparri, heal wound of many years. While our people should have their attention on prophecy, it was directed elsewhere, the man of sin and what he stood for. Now let us go to the second focus of attention. Page 5. In this second focus of attention, we'll note on the secular line in 1948, the Jewish state of Israel was established. And on the church line, we'll find in 1950 that God sent two messengers to the church, Whedon and Short. And in 1952, there was a Bible conference held in Tacoma Park. And finally, in 1955 and 56, the SDA Evangelical Conferences resulted in the book, Questions on Doctrine. Now, if you'll turn to page 6, we're going to focus our attention first on the event of 1948. What is interesting about how the church looked at that event at the time is found in the Bible Conference of 1952, published in the book, Our Firm Foundation, Volume 2, page 230, in which Arthur Maxwell, noting what happened in 1948, says this: "Victorious as were the forces of Israel in every other part of Palestine, they failed to take the most dazzling object is of all. Mysteriously, they were held back from achieving this most cherished goal, this culminating triumph, as by an unseen hand." And he's talking about the capture of Jerusalem. And then he asks the question, what could be the reason? Only at the time of the Gentiles. Again, events were starting to transpire. Events that you pointed out as guidelines, as section corners, as we look to the end time. Well, 1950, 2 years later, these two young men at the time, Whedon and Short, wrote their book, their manuscript, 1888 Reexamined. And in this book, 1888 Reexamined, they said that the church and its leadership had rejected the messages of 1888, and that there was a need for denominational repentance so that God could look with favor once more upon the church. They said what the effect was all about. In 1952, in the middle of his administration as president of the General Conference, W.H. Branson called for his Bible conference. I attended it. The messages that were given at this Bible conference were doctrinally sound. There was only one message given during the time that really raised ripples and caused some trouble, and that was one given by Heppenstall. Otherwise, except for just variations of belief in certain minor ideas, they preached the fundamental historic message of our historic Adventist doctrine, all the way through. And you can read it in the two volumes that were issued on this particular Bible conference. And at the close, Branson himself spoke. And I want you to notice carefully what he said. To a large degree, the church failed to build on the foundation laid at the 1888 General Conference. Now, that's as close as he would come to admitting that what had been submitted 2 years before was correct. He's saying they failed to build. Whedon and Short said they rejected it. Much has been lost as a result. We are years behind where we should have been in spiritual growth. Long ere this, we should have been in the promised land. I was noting certain principles. But the message of righteousness by faith given in the 1888 conference has been repeated here. Practically every speaker from the first day onward has laid great stress upon its all-important doctrine, and there was no prearranged plan that he should do so. It was spontaneous on the part of the speakers. No doubt they were impelled by the Spirit of God to do so. Truly, this one subject has in this conference swallowed up all others. But this great truth has been given to us here in 1952 Bible conference with far greater power than it was given in the 1888 conference, because those who have spoken here have had the advantage of much added light shining forth from hundreds of pronouncements on this subject in the writings of the Spirit of Prophecy, which those who spoke back there did not have. The light of justification and righteousness by faith shines upon us today more clearly than it ever shone before upon any people. No longer will the question be, what was the attitude of our workers and people toward the message of righteousness by faith that was given in 1888? What did they do about it? From now on, the great question must be, what did we do with the light on righteousness by faith as proclaimed in the 1952 Bible Conference? But observe, he said nothing about repentance. Now the third focus of our attention, page 7, will involve the dates from 67 to 80 in church history and from 67 to 84 in secular history. In 1967, among other things, Seventh-day Adventist was appointed to the Faith and Order Commission of the World Council of Churches with General Conference approval. In 1977, the Seventh-day Adventist Church, through an official representative, presented the church in symbol to the Pope, then Pope Paul VI, or the Antichrist. In 1979, the annual council authorizes an apostate statement of belief to be presented to the General Conference in session, and in 1980, a Dallas session of the General Conference votes the apostate statement of beliefs. At the same time, in secular history, the Israelis capture Jerusalem. Pope John Paul II is welcomed to the White House. The capital of Israel is moved to Jerusalem, and in 1984, the U.S. Vatican ties an exchange of ambassadors. Now, the facts that have happened within the church and the events concerning Jerusalem in 1967 cannot be gainsaid. The documentation for it is too clear. These are facts of history that have taken place. The giving of the medallion to the Pope in 1977 carries a significance of the deepest moment. The Review and Herald, and this is documented, the Review and Herald stated that B.B. Beach presented as a symbol of the church, a medallion of the church to Pope Paul VI. If I should give to you, as a mayor of a city, the key to the city, oh, that which represents the city, what am I doing? I'm symbolically placing that city in your hands and at your disposal. No matter how much of a denial they wish to put forth, a symbol, a gold symbol, 24 karat gold, memorializing the church, was put in the hands of the Pope in 1977. Now, the parallels between Seventh-day Adventist history and events concerning both the papacy and Jerusalem interlock. Now, keep in mind, I go back to the statements of 1901. In 1901, the Spirit of the Lord said, the scenes that will be connected with Jerusalem are going to be tied in by Jesus to the very final scenes of this earth's history. We need to study the working of the mystery of iniquity that will play so largely in the closing scenes of this world's history. Two things, two markers. Now I want you to notice very carefully the interlocking. And you can jot this down on your notes also. On October 9th, in 1979, was the annual council that voted to recommend to the General Conference in session in 1980 a statement of beliefs drawn up by Andrews University, which in reality was more apostate than what they actually voted. Now notice, on October the 6th, just prior to this, 1979, 3 days difference, Carter welcomed the Pope into the White House. The correlation of dates. That's one correlation. On April 17th, 1980, the General Conference convened in Dallas, Texas. This General Conference is the one that voted the 1980 Statements of Belief that altered various historical positions that had been appeared in previous statements of belief. Then, on July 30th, 1980, the Parliament, the Knesset of Israel, transferred the capital from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem, thus making complete Israel's domination of the city of Jerusalem. In other words, we took an action denying our faith. God let the last event that closed off the period of the closing of the time of the Gentiles take place within weeks of each other. The correlation between these two things cannot be overlooked and cannot be denied. Into this focus must be brought a testimony which prior to this time had no time nor place. I want you to turn to page 8 and note with me this testimony. Nowhere in time prior to this time that we're living in now could this testimony have any significance. It's taken from the Review and Herald of December 13, 1892, 3 weeks after she had written, "The time of test is just upon us, for the loud cry of the third angel has already begun, and the message of the revelation angel is going to lighten the earth with glory." Within 3 weeks of that, this testimony appeared and no one could understand it. Now let's take a look. As God called the children of Israel out of Egypt, that they might keep his Sabbath, so he calls his people out of Babylon, that they might not worship the beast or his image. The man of sin who brought it to thought to change times and laws has exalted himself above God by presenting a spurious Sabbath to the world. The Christian world has accepted the child of the papacy and cradled and nourished it, thus defying God by removing his memorial and setting up a rival Sabbath. What is she saying? As the children of Israel were called out of Egypt that they might keep his Sabbath, so he calls his people out of Babylon. Isn't that the message of the Adventist church that was giving? The second angel's message? Now notice what it says. After the truth has been proclaimed as a witness to all nations. After. What truth? The Sabbath truth, calling a lot of Babylon not to keep this child of the papacy. After that truth has been proclaimed as a witness to all nations. Why could the brother not understand that? Because we had preached Matthew 24:14, and this gospel of the kingdom shall be preached as a witness to all the world, and then what? Then shall the end come. But she didn't say study Matthew 24. What did she say study? Luke 21. Our brethren could not understand it because they said, "Let's get the gospel to all the world. Let's preach it to all the creatures under heaven, and then what? Jesus will come. We'll have completed our task." And here she says that after the truth has been proclaimed as a witness to all nations, there's going to be something happen other than the second coming of Christ. Now, my friend, when could the time of this prophecy come? When would be the time and place? Only after Luke 21:24 had been fulfilled. It would have no relevance before then. Now, what does she say is going to happen? Hijacking? What do they call these groups that make the raids? What? Terrorist activities, drug addiction, every conceivable power will be set in operation. And then note, and minds will be confused by many voices crying, "Lo, here is Christ, lo, he is there, this is the truth, I have the message from God, he has sent me with great light." Then there will be a removing of the landmarks and an attempt to tear down the pillars of our faith. A more decided effort will be made to exalt the false Sabbath and cast contempt upon God himself by supplanting the day he has blessed and sanctified. This false Sabbath is to be enforced by an oppressive law. Satan and his angels are wide awake and intensely active, working with energy and perseverance through human instrumentalities to bring about his purpose of obliterating from the mind of men the knowledge of God. But while Satan works with his lying wonders. The time will be fulfilled, foretold in the Revelation, and the mighty angel that shall lighten the earth with his glory will proclaim the fall of Babylon and call upon God's people to forsake us. At that time, at the time of the loud cry of the third angel, those who have been in any measure blinded by the enemy, who have not fully recovered themselves from the snare of Satan, will be in peril because it will be difficult for them to discern the light from heaven, and they will be inclined to accept falsehood. Their erroneous experience will color their thoughts, their decisions, their propositions, their counsel. The evidence that God has given will be no evidence to those who have blinded their eyes by choosing darkness rather than light. After rejecting light, they will originate theories which they call light, but which the Lord calls sparks of their own kindling, by which they will direct their steps. This testimony is tremendous. Now let me reason with you about it for just a moment. It says here that after the truth has been proclaimed as a witness to all nations, then there will be a removing of the landmarks and an attempt to tear down the pillars of our faith. Now let me ask you a simple question. Has there been a removing of the landmarks and an attempt to pull down the pillars of our faith? The evidence is there, isn't it? Then what does that tell you? The truth has been proclaimed as a witness to all nations. Either, if you say that the truth has not been proclaimed as a witness to all nations, then you're going to have to say that this present, what we call apostasy, is not apostasy, but it's God's further light to his people, and we ought to walk in it. You don't have many choices when you get down to this. Now let's go one step further and take a look at this by comparison. Now notice the distinguishing separations between this message and what was going to take place in 1892. Turn to page 9. All right, on page 9, in 1892, she said, "The time of test is just before us." I think the word should be upon us. "For the loud cry of the third angel has already begun in the revelation of the righteousness of Christ, the sin-pardoning Redeemer. This is the beginning of the light of the angel whose glory shall fill the whole earth." All right. Now, where were the greater number of God's people at that time? In the Great Controversy, page 390, published in 1888, "Notwithstanding the spiritual darkness and alienation from God that exists in the churches which constitute Babylon, the great body of Christ's true followers are still to be found in their communion." That's where that was. Now then, if the loud cry had gone forth then, what would we have seen? Multitudes flocking in. But in this other statement, the loud cry comes when? After the truth has been proclaimed. Then what are we going to see? If the truth has already been proclaimed as a witness to all nations and the message is going to come out of Babylon, how many are left out there? You see the difference of the picture? All right, now, she says in the statement that comes in December 13, 1892, they can find only time and place in this present setting. She said the landmarks will be removed and there will be attempts to remove the pillars of our faith. What about back in 1888? In 1889, she says, in Minneapolis, God gave precious gems of truth to his people in new settings. This light from heaven by some was rejected with all the stubbornness the Jews manifest in rejecting Christ, and there was much talk about standing by the old landmarks. But there was evidence that they knew not what the old landmarks were. There was evidence and there was reasoning from the Lord that commended itself to the conscience, but the minds of men were fixed, steeled against the entrance of light, because they had decided it was a dangerous error removing the old landmarks when it was not removing a peg of the old landmarks, but they had perverted ideas of what constituted the old landmarks. All right, back in 1888, she says there was no removal of the landmarks. In the New Testament, what is she saying? There will be a removing of the landmarks. Now, my friends, that makes different section corners. And it's these differences that we need to understand. and we need to understand them very, very carefully. Now let's go back to page 8, and I want you to notice something. That second paragraph again. After the truth has been proclaimed as a witness to all nations, every conceivable power of evil will be set in operation, and minds, plural, will be confused by many voices. Is there any confusion today in the Adventist world? Confusion on every hand. And what brings it about? Many voices crying what? Lo, here is Christ. Lo, he is there. This is the truth. I have the message from God. He has sent me with great light. Now, she's borrowing language, no quotes. But the language that she borrows, lo, here is Christ, lo, he is there, this is the truth, and so forth. Those are the words of Jesus when he talks about the last days. And those who are saying that he's Christ, or lo, Christ is there, and have the message, are they of God or are they of men? When Christ uses the word of men. And so she's putting the many voices in what category? Not voices of God, but voices of men that produce what? Confusion. All right, let me just ask you a question. Are we living today when there are many voices crying to the Adventists, I have a great truth, I have great light? All right, turn to that last page, page 10, and let's take a look. All right, let's just start down through it. Prior to the beginning of the loud cry in 1892, there were a few dissident voices that had been heard. There was B.F. Snook and W.H. Brinkerhoff of the Marian Party and D.M. Cantwright. And the dates are given. Along the timeline since 1900, there have been reform movements. A.F. Ballinger, 1914, the SDA reform movement in 1925, the Shepherd's Rod led by B.T. Howdiff in 1929, and Robert D. Brinsmead about 1960. Now, there may have been a few others at that time that I haven't mentioned or brought in, but this covers 50 years. However, it says that after the truth has been proclaimed as a witness to all nations, there will be heard in harmony with the testimony many voices. Now, let's take a look. Now, there has been a breakaway or a continuation of the Robert Brinsmead teaching of Decade 1. There's G. Harvey Rule and his publication, The Layworker. Vance Farrell and his publication of Pilgrim's Rest. Now, I want to say just a word here. I sent out cards, return address cards, to a group of these individuals asking them when they began their particular teaching. And you know how many cards I've gotten back? None. I can't understand why they don't want to answer the phone. Now, I know that Vance Farrell, for a while, when he was in Illinois, dealt with making tapes, reading the Great Controversy for presentation on radio stations. And then he went from that into trying to set before God's people certain things that were taking place in the church. And the closest I can come is the date, 1980, that I received from a man who was writing about some of these things just a few days ago. And then there's Fred Wright, who is a breakaway from Brinsmead and considers himself the angel of Revelation 18. Now, that's the background there. All breaking away from the Brinsmead defection of the 60s. Then there is the continued protest of the compromise of 1955 and 56 in the book Questions on Doctrine on the Part of One and the Organizational Apostasy in their respective former church affiliations. And so I've listed now the names and their themes. There's Elder Bauer. His theme is no organization. There's Elder Nicolish. His concept is no organization and salvation by works based on reforms. Now let's notice the new voices that have come. Willard Santee. His tapes on the circle of apostasy were good. But he's now back in that circle himself. And that happened about 1981. He's renounced all that he said before. Then there's Mike Kluke. And again, I had to take an approximate date, 1981, and his theme, God Does Not Destroy. Thomas Van Asperen considers himself the fourth angel's ministry. Robert Hauser, M.D., in his book, To God Under God Be the Glory, or something of that nature, is an application of Desmond Ford's hermeneutics to the book of Revelation, the Jesuitical futuristic interpretation. J. Reynolds Hoffman, his deliverance ministry, casting out devils, about 1983. And the sad thing is that J. Reynolds Hoffman was an outstanding evangelist. And in his teaching in evangelism, he taught Luke 21:24 accurately, along with Daniel 11, chapter verse 45, and Daniel 12:1. And not only does he teach a futuristic interpretation of prophecy, but some of his concepts he gathered right from the evangelical press. Michael Hodges, Pagan Origins of Christian Symbols, Ezekiel 8. And then there's a firm foundation conference with the Heartland Institute. There's an emphasis on historic Adventist doctrine. No question about that. And then there's a committee of five. And the spokesmen for the committee of five are Robert J. Wieland and Alexander Schneeman. And I'm sure that these men will not like the idea that I've classified them with these voices. But they're giving the 1888 message in the time setting of 1950 instead of in the time setting of 1986. Now, they themselves say that they do not accept that the 1980 statement of beliefs are not their confession. They do not agree with them. But that's where the church stands. And whether their names are still in the church books, they are still outside of the pale of the church. And therefore, they're among those voices. But the tragedy is, by teaching the 1888 message correctly, they are putting their listeners on enchanted ground, thrilled with that message, but placing them there where they can be deceived, because they're telling those individuals, continue to support the apostasy and that statement of belief which they themselves will not accept. And then at last, as Marty Wald, the church has become Babylon. Now, to this number three category, the new voices, could be added other voices in their publications. There's not a single voice of any of the above-named persons, either verbally or in their publications, faced up to the light given in the article of the Review and Herald, December 13, 1892. There's not a one of them to speak to it. They avoid it like poison. They ignore it. They will have nothing to do with it. And yet that constitutes a cornerstone, a survey corner that we must deal with in the hour to which we've come. They either reject outright every one of them, or they seek to mitigate its force even as does the church. But the prophecy of Jesus in Luke 21:24 and the article are saying the same things and are pointing to the same time period. We need to rethink carefully what this testimony has to say to us as far as the loud cry is concerned. Let's notice the text. If you have your Bibles, take your Bibles and turn to Ezekiel. Ezekiel, the 9th chapter and verse 1. Notice what it says there. Ezekiel 9:1. And this has to do with the time of the sealing. He cried also in mine ears with what? A loud voice. What is a loud cry? A loud voice. He cried in mine ears with a loud voice. There's another reference that I want you to take note of, and it's the Review and Herald of February 11, 1896. Another interesting one. My mind was carried to the future when the signal will be given. Behold, the bridegroom cometh, go ye out to meet him. The son of delayed to obtain the oil for replenishing their lamps, and too late they will find the character which is represented by the oil is not transferable. But what does she say? My mind was carried into the future. Already the church had talked about the bridegroom, the midnight cry, back in 1844, and we had a shut door back there that caused a lot of trouble and a lot of misunderstanding. But in 1896, she says, My mind was carried in the future when the signal will be given, behold, the bridegroom cometh, go ye out to meet him. And what is that signal? Well, turn to Matthew, the 25th chapter, and find out what it says there. Because it's this text that's being referred to. Sixth verse of Matthew 25. And at midnight, there was a cry made. Behold, the bridegroom cometh, go ye out to meet him. A cry at midnight? A signal? A loud cry? Is it possible? What is it? Behold, the bridegroom cometh, go ye out to meet him. Now, in this reference, now we've noted here that it could have no time or place until this present hour. It does mention the fact that there will be an oppressive Sunday law. No question. But it's not connected with the idea of a national Sunday law. It's connected when the truth has been given as a witness to all nations. It's something worldwide in extent that's referred to there. The Sunday law is not denied. It's taken out of the setting of a national Sunday law and put into a worldwide picture, and it is put in a picture that after the truth has been given, after many voices, and after the removing of the landmarks and the pillars of our faith. You see, today we live in a pluralistic society, and we can't deny it. A society that deifies recreational activities above God. And when are the most of the recreational activities able to be seen by the American public? What? Sunday afternoon? When are the big games played? And an act is National Sunday Law? Now, this whole recreational aspect that's connected with Sunday keeping, Sunday observance, or the lack of Sunday observance today, is the very thing that Bakayoko is striking at and refers to it in relationship to the Lord's Day. A whole new approach. May I use the term a whole new ball game? Now let's turn to Isaiah, the second chapter, and see another verse. Isaiah 2, verse 3. And first, maybe we will notice the second verse for the times, for the setting of these verses. And it shall come to pass in the last days that the mountain of the Lord's house shall be established at the tops of the mountains. Third verse. And many people shall go and say, come, let us go to the mountain of the Lord, to the house of the God of Jacob, and he will teach us his ways, and we will walk in his paths. Who's going to be teaching in Jerusalem? Who's going to say that he's Lord and teaching in Jerusalem? Who do we believe? All right, and he says, for out of Zion shall go forth the law and the word of the Lord from Jerusalem. And it's this prophecy that the present Pope has his attention focused on and talks about. And only as we get the timeline correct due to a new survey marker, corner, can we know what we should do in this present hour. Only as we get the thing set up and not misinterpret what the spirit of prophecy has to say. And that's the only way we're going to get a correct timeline and be able to evaluate history and the events in their proper sequence and what's taking place. Now, do you have any questions?